information is free.
The law?
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge,
we care.
Here to border
and it
on
shows.
Defense.
The law?
The country.
Beware, remember, nine you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, it made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
You're on the air, and we know you're scared. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 214 from Media Monarchy. My name's James Evan Pilato, your host and webmaster of the site and show, MediaMonarchy.com, your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. It's April 15th, 2011, state-run radio, Sidney Lumet, and the Star Suckers Network. Royal rituals, prophetic pillars, and burqa bans. Facebook, fake book, revolutions, and tales from the vault. Unprepared updates, news purge, and the Civil War shots. All that and so much more. April 15th, 2011, episode 214 from MediaMonarchy.com.
You must be a radio station. And who are we? We must be a number one song spinning all day long. And over again, and over again, and over again, and over again, and over again. We don't win, we'll be calling. And nothing's free, sounds for me. Let's stay down, radio, stay down. Interrupt this broadcast to bring you the special message about the forecast. The future's cloudy and it's raining on the poor class. Road to peace is closed, heavy traffic on the war paths. Love is balling on the budget. The military says it's gonna need more cash to keep fighting for your gas. Keep us in our hoods and hope we never explore past. Stay inside of your half. Believe the lies you learned in your class, that there's no treasure in your trash. And a Sealy has the same feeling that the floor has, and that's where you should stay. This is what they play.
Over again, and 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 over again. And we don't win, we'll be coming. And nothing's free, sound for me. Let's stay fun. Radio, stay fun.
You're now tuned into the weakest frequency of fear. Keep you locked right here and hope you never leave this. Never be a leader. Think inside the box and follow our procedures. Never ever believe that you will never need this. Hit up all your friends and tell them to repeat this. How you're on the air, now what you wanna hear? Well, we ain't got the truth, but how about a remix? Different is never good. Good is only what we pick. You ain't got a hit unless it sounds like these did. Not too smart, you will be a superstar. And if you dumb as some, maybe you could be number one.
Over again, and over again, and over again, and over again, and over again. And we don't win, we'll be coming. And nothing's free, sound for me. Let's stay fun. Radio, 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 stay fun. Radio.
So be with us on the airwaves and be more aware of what's not getting airplay. Independent spirits, you can barely hear what they're saying. Truth ain't getting on like shampoo on an airplane. Propaganda's everywhere, constantly on replay. All the hits all the time, back to back on relay. We're really where it lives, make them hear the records we play. Build your own station, become your own DJ.
A radio station, and who are we?
one song, spilling all day long, and you put me in daily rotation. You're on the air, we know you're scared, but we don't care, we'll play this here.
The latest revelation from Lasers. That's Lupe Fiasco featuring Self. And you may recall a few weeks ago we played Words I Never Said from Lupe Fiasco's new record Lasers that references pulling Building 7 and engineered financial collapse. And that song and that album has been on my mobile music device for quite some time, and when I heard that track we just heard, State Run Radio, I instantly recognized that sounds like Self. Huge fan of Self. They are from Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and their two great records from the early 2000s are called Breakfast with Girls and Gizmodgerie. And that's how the media synchronicities work, my friends. Let me welcome you more formally here to the 214th episode of Media Monarchy. It's April 15th, 2011, and my name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show, MediaMonarchy.com. Coming to you live, as always, from the Portland Radio Authority, PRARadio.org. With technical difficulties in hand, I believe our server is presently dead. But that's not going to stop the Media Monarchy train, so with huge thanks to the folks at ZeroPointRadio.com for their simulcast of this very show right now, April 15th. Worldwide on the web on ZeroPointRadio.com and terrestrially in Casper, Wyoming, 92.3 FM and 1670 AM. Helping me out in the chat room, ground control to Major Jim. We were able to rig up a solution. So we're streaming this show live on Ustream.tv. And the links are there on the page, and I've put it on Facebook.com/Media Monarchy, and it's been tweeted out to Twitter.com/Media Monarchy. But I don't let the live get me down when things don't always quite go right, because I know that the majority of the listeners come through the podcast later. And I appreciate you, one and all. If you're listening live, wherever you are in the world, welcome with open arms. This is not a fear-based Patriot Games-type alternative media conspiracy show. We don't spend our time attacking other hosts we might not like. I have faith that the audience out there are astute enough, and as we're all trying to help each other learn and grow and become more media literate, to say the very least, you know what's up, and I think that's why you dig MediaMonarchy.com, the most jam-packed, media-rific 2 hours in weekly radio, but sometimes it's even more than that. We recorded a B-side episode just a little bit ago, so again, feeds.feedburner.com/MediaMonarchy, you'll get everything. And everything we reference on this radio show is in some way, shape, or form linked and represented in the Media Monarchy Kingdom. I'm a little OCD in that. It's all in there. I've also been experimenting with putting more info within the podcast. So you now have interactive contents of all the links and all the stories and all the headlines and everything we cite and source and use on this show. On your mobile player, it may pop right up. And I try and cram every field I can with some kind of data that iTunes will let me do. And I sometimes wonder why other folks out there don't take the opportunity to fill out every field. But we're bursting at the seams with media memes here, my friends. And so, yes, thanks to the Portland Radio Authority, that has been the home of Media Monarchy in its radio form since the very beginning, October 2006. And we thank ZeroPointRadio.com, and we also thank RevereRadio.net, the worldwide home of free speech. Thanks to Radio23.org for the extra hosting, and of course, thanks to TragedyAndHope.com for the moral support and the fantastic community of folks over there. And as we said, FaceSpace, TwitterTube, Gmail, Skype, all those things, Media Monarchy. Hit the donate button if you find this alternative media enriching to your life. Does this fulfill your life? And that's the question you should ask about all the media that you take in. Life's too short to take in ridiculous, bad media. And as we begin this show, April 15th, 2011, episode 214, we always like to glance at the breaking news. Tornadoes overnight leave at least 9 dead in Little Rock, Arkansas, as well as Oklahoma, and we are keeping an extra eye on the area around Arkansas as it has been the site of some of the first mass animal die-offs that we saw earlier this year. January 1st, to be precise. And the speculation of a possible earthquake on the New Madrid fault line right there. Meanwhile, the Arizona House okays a bill to make presidential hopefuls prove citizenship. And that's under the subheading of birther on Google News. And I suppose in some way, we should be proud that the term 9/11 truther, which we are, it's how I got involved in all of this. I'm a college radio guy, that's where I came from, but the events of 9/11 caused me to look a little deeper. And so I've taken my media sound design program director at a college independent non-commercial radio station, playing with a band, doing sound design for theater, all of those things. Now morphed into an alternative news show. I digress much too much for the amount of material we have to go over, but I have things written on my notes that I want to mention for you. Because we opened with state-run radio, and that reminds me, I watched a film from 1977. That's when I'm from. Released in 1979, and it's called On the Air Live with Captain Midnight. It's pretty bad, but it's about a guy who starts a pirate radio station in his van. And of course, yes, it came from Netflix. And of course, yes, we're working behind the scenes to hopefully very soon get NavigatingNetflix.com operating and helping you cut through the garbage. But of course, Captain Midnight had a few good samples that I was able to grab. You always gotta grab samples. You never know when you're gonna have a radio show that you need to play them on. We also want to throw out a reference to the Coachella concert that starts this weekend in Indio, California. And thanks to Alan in Omaha, who not only writes amazing original pieces on cyberspacewar.com, but he sent me a book called The Last Circle concerning Danny Casolaro, the Prama Software, Inslaw, and the Octopus. As you may know, Danny Casolaro, investigative journalist, was found dead in a hotel room in Martinsburg, West Virginia. West Virginia being my home state. The Coachella concert takes place near the Cabazon Indian Reservation, and there are also military connections there. I haven't been able to find out a whole lot about the origins of the concert and the lands itself. If anyone has any info on that, please send it my way, as I'm extremely interested in that, as it's something that folks like Peter LaVenda have talked about in Sinister Forces, that isn't it interesting, all of our facilities that seem to be on Indian burial grounds that are military bases and prisons. And yes, Woodstock 99 was on a retired military base, and look where that got you. So, again, in addition to a growing Twitter feed and Facebook and all of that stuff, you can send me an email, mediamonarchy@gmail.com. And we're going to get into it. I feel compelled to mention all of the things, because as I've tried to explain on the show before, Media Monarchy, for me, the idea are those media synchronicities and the wide-eyed exploration I've always felt about the arts, film, music. Last Thursday night, I was watching the extras disc of Network, and it contained some amazing clips and interviews that I had never seen before. And I neglected to mention last week that I was watching that and didn't reference it in any way. And then Saturday morning, late Friday night, it was announced, and we'll take this from CBS News, Sidney Lumet, director of Network and 12 Angry Men and so many other films, dies at the age of 86. News Junkie Post has an article about the acclaimed director's films and how so many of them explored social issues. But again, from CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System. Acclaimed filmmaker Sidney Lumet died at the age of 86, left a legacy of classic films, many of which dealt with crime and justice. 12 Angry Men, The Anderson Tapes, Serpico, Dog Day Afternoon, Murder on the Orient Express, Night Falls on Manhattan, to name just a few. But as great as they are, they pale next to Network, the 1976 satire of television that won 4 Oscars. Written by Paddy Chayefsky, who, like Lumet, got his start in live television in the 1950s, the film tells of a broadcast network's news division taken over by an entertainment executive played by Faye Dunaway, who had unusual ideas about journalism. Peter Finch earned an Oscar for his performance as Howard Beale, the news anchor knocked off the air for mental instability, only to be returned in front of the camera as a ratings driver in the guise of a mad prophet of the airwaves. His message? Don't believe what you see and hear on TV. The audience eats it up. In one of the many links we have in this story for you, and we'll hear it referenced, of course, as if you hadn't heard it before, that Beale, after wandering the streets in the rain, arrived at the studio to deliver not the news, but a challenge to his audience and to the society in general to reject feeling powerless against the political and media forces of the world. Sidney Lumet, director of Network and 12 Angry Men, dies at the age of 86.
Paddy Chayefsky came to me one day, and we had worked together on live television. And he was somebody that I deeply loved, and I miss him every day today. And said, Sidney, you want to do a movie about television, about the good old days? And I said, sure, Paddy. And then, of course, I didn't hear from him for 2 years. And then one day, the script of Network arrived.
Ladies and gentlemen, I would like at this moment to announce that I will be retiring from this program in 2 weeks' time. Because of poor ratings. Since this show was the only thing I had going for me in my life, I have decided to kill myself.
What'd she say?
I'm going to blow my brains out right on this program a week from today.
10 seconds to commercial.
Oh, tune in next Tuesday. That should give the public relations people a week to promote the show.
The glorious thing about Network, because I think it's top-flight Chayefsky, is that everybody keeps saying to us, oh, what a brilliant satire. And Patty and I kept saying, it's not a satire, it's sheer reportage. And we've turned out to be right. I mean, if you've seen any news program today, you can see how prescient that movie was.
And what's wrong with being an angry prophet denouncing the hypocrisies of our times? What do you think, Max?
Do you want to be an angry prophet denouncing the hypocrisies of our times?
Yeah, I think I'd like to be an angry prophet denouncing the hypocrisies of our times.
I was worried about Peter Finch because I felt the movie was so intrinsically American. And certainly every major anchor at that time, Walter Cronkite or Tom Chandler, was so American. But Peter was a brilliant actor. And he called one day. He knew that we were talking about him. And he said, look, I hear my agent tells me you're worried about the acting. He said, I've got the New York Times here. He was down in Bermuda, Barbados, somewhere in the Caribbean. He said, you'll get a tape from me the day after tomorrow and listen to it. And he sent us a tape reading the New York Times with perfect, what we would call mid-Atlantic speech. And he got the part.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
From Al Pacino in Dog Day Afternoon to Paul Newman in The Verdict, the list of actors directed by Sidney Lumet reads like a who's who of Hollywood. Sean Connery, Dustin Hoffman, Jane Fonda, even Michael Jackson.
I think movies have probably said more about this country than anything.
Lumet said the best films not only entertain, but make viewers examine their consciences. His first film, 1957's 12 Angry Men, explored prejudices inside the jury room.
They're no good. There's not a one of them who's any good.
Network, his satirical take on television news, provided one of Hollywood's most repeated lines.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Born in 1924, Lumet entered show business as a child actor, but his real talent was behind the camera. Over 50 years, he directed more than 40 films, including Serpico, Murder on the Orient Express, The Morning After, and his last movie, 2007's Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. Lumet's personal life was tumultuous, with weddings to actress Rita Gam, glamorous heiress Gloria Vanderbilt, and Gail Horn, daughter of Lena Horn. In 1980, he married his fourth wife, Mary Gimbel, a marriage that lasted until he died. In a notoriously spendthrift industry, Lumet stood out for bringing in his movies under schedule and under budget. He lived and breathed New York City, the setting of many of his films.
There's a certain world that I know very well, and that is that world. I know street life.
Lumet never wanted to live in Hollywood, which some thought is one of the reasons he never won an Oscar, until the Academy finally gave him an honorary Oscar in 2005 for Lifetime Achievement. Sidney Lumet was 86. Perry McCarthy, CBS News, Hollywood.
Now, when I look at Lumet's filmography, I'm surprised at so many of those films that I have seen. And he has a huge filmography and no real discernible style to his films, but I know one of them that we referenced, the Anderson tapes, at one point was streaming on Netflix, and that's all about surveillance. So while we're discussing this and while we're discussing media and memes, and we have other related media meme updates that are unbelievable, I was listening to episode 21 from peacerevolution.org. The fantastic new podcast from Richard Grove of TragedyandHope.com and all the other related folks, Jan Irvin of Gnostic Media, Paul Verge of Divergent Films, Lisa Arbacheski. And referenced in there, and I don't have it in front of me, so I can't do it justice right now, but Richard pointed out something that he learned from somewhere else, and again, that's how this all works. We all have to teach and learn from each other. That the underlying bit in Network is actually putting Beale on the air to stop those Arabs from buying the network. And that had never hit me before. And when you then think that both Paddy Chayefsky and Sidney Lumet are both Jewish and started out doing Yiddish theater, a film with the understory against those evil Arabs starts to make a lot more sense. And those are the kind of things that we hope to go into on NavigatingNetflix.com. Our other related media memes and updates, the Chemical Brothers and other mainstream artists take over movie scores. Now, on our previously recorded B-side episode 213, we ended with a track from the Chemical Brothers and their score to the new film, Hannah. But this article on the DA Online notes that we want it all when it comes to movies. Big actors, bigger action, and darn good reasons to shell out an extra $3 for flimsy 3D glasses. I don't really put myself into any of those categories. But when does studio gratification become too much gratification? Big name musicians have jumped from releasing albums to releasing soundtracks. In a world of indie darlings, these artists are selling their souls to studio execs as the box office is bombarded with potential soundtracks. And this isn't just Death Cab for Cutie writing a song for Twilight, this is Daft Punk scoring the entirety of Tron Legacy. Sure, it's brilliant, but is it necessary? And is it improving movie music? The recent victims of this phenomenon include Where the Wild Things Are, The Social Network, Tron Legacy, and now Hannah. Sometimes the soundtrack will be bigger than the actors' names, and one will find a film scored by, insert band named here, and will continue to see this on every poster, web widget, and toy box for 6 months before the release date. Without a doubt, the integrated marketing of the gimmick is effective. This goes on to talk about the bands receiving articles on websites and the fans and blah, blah, blah. I would ultimately say, as you may very well know, since we've featured in the last year music from Tron and Social Network and now Hannah, that not only do I wholeheartedly approve and excitedly await more musicians from bands doing film scores, if you've known me for a long time, you would know that I kind of hoped and predicted this, and in one small way even hoped to be a part of it back in the day. That's why I started to pull my band that I played with into doing scores for plays. We even put out a 7-inch of music recorded originally for a play. You can check that out, actually, at magnanimous.org. I would ultimately say anything that can stop the same 5 dudes from winning Oscars for score every year, like John Williams and Hans Zimmer and Thomas Newman, bring it on. Some of my favorite soundtracks are done by musicians. Brave New World among top 10 books Americans most want banned. That is from The Guardian. And it gets a lot of complaints because of the sex. As do most of the other books get complaints because they contain homosexual references, but it's quite interesting. Catherine Zeta-Jones apparently checked herself into a mental health facility for bipolar disorder. Meanwhile, Glenn Beck started wearing some bizarre Freemasonic patch during his broadcasts. And the Chinese media have banned time travel.
Just when you thought that the Chinese censors couldn't get any more sensitive, the authorities here have decided to ban time travel from all television programs. The government has issued a whole new set of guidelines and says that TV dramas shouldn't have characters that travel back in time and rewrite history. They say that this goes against China's cultural heritage. They also say that myths, superstitions, and reincarnation are all questionable. Now, nobody really knows why the government has issued these new set of rules now, but the government does strictly control the media, and also a lot of these programs have become more and more popular over the past couple of months. Now, the government does heavily censor programs that it deems unhealthy or it believes are threatening to the government. And in fact, the authorities here now have some suggestions for television producers here, saying that they might want to create some programs that showcase the progress of the Chinese leadership, which also happens to coincide with the 90th anniversary of the founding of the Communist Party. Eunice Yun, CNN, Sanya, China.
Censors? Where we're going, we don't need censors. Our last related media meme update posted below the Sidney Lumet obituary on MediaMonarchy.com. It's bad news. ABC cancels All My Children and One Life to Live after decades on the air. And it is fascinating, as crappy as most of those things are and not really worth any attention, but that anything that goes back to starting on radio, I do find noteworthy, at least in some small way. Our next post is Star Suckers, a documentary about the cult of corporate fame. And this was one of the many things that I was going to get into on last week's episode, but we just ran out of time. The entire documentary is up on blip.tv, where it notes, Star Suckers is the most controversial documentary of the year. It's a darkly humorous and shocking expose of the celebrity-obsessed media that uncovers the real reasons behind our addiction to fame and blows the lid on corporations and the individuals who profit from it. Star Suckers.
Everybody is naturally and powerfully attracted to fame, even though most people will deny it. This principle has allowed us access into every part of your world and is now the foundation of our entire business. These are the five lessons that need to be learned to be able to use fame as a means of control. In different ways, they all take advantage of your basic needs and desires. It's only through a combination of these lessons that one can master the greatest illusion of them all. An illusion so great, it has given us a seat at the tables of power throughout the world and unlimited influence in raising the next generation. Our first lesson is all about motivation. As our business depends on everybody believing that they can succeed. We like this message to be absorbed as young as possible, because kids that follow the dream will always be our best customers. So, from the day they're born, we convince kids that the key to happiness lies in the entertainment industry.
It's all about the personality.
That's what I always thought. Now, I'm still digesting Star Suckers, and a big thanks to Paul Verge of Divergent Films for turning me onto that. And I love how the film narrates as if it's coming from the united voice of the cabal, of the organizations, of the interlocking multinational corporations that, of course, even as they say in Network, there are no nations, there are no countries, there's only Shell and IBM and the Rockefellers. But I like that it's done that way. And I did think that. That's what I was saying. That's what I used to think. I had a strange growing up in being kept away from movies and music, with an upbringing in Southern Baptist Christian Church in Southern West Virginia. And of course, I loved it when the guys would come and talk about rock music. And I remember them showing pictures and slides and things of the occult in the media. Pictures of Michael J. Fox at the height of Back to the Future fame, which again was one of my favorites, at least a little later, on the cover of Rolling Stone looking into a crystal ball. And I probably would have gotten stuck in the pop world, were it not, thanks, and I don't know where he got it from, but in the shoebox my brother had hidden under the bed, he had spoken word albums from Jello Biafra. And it was that that really turned me on, and it was that that really blew my mind, and it was that from which we take our now motto of Media Monarchy: don't hate the media, become the media. We shift now to the latest site in the kingdom, and I'll have to admit it's the one I've been more excited about recently, and it also could just come from the fact that there seems to be so many stories that are perfect for holyhexes.com. And as the royal ritual approaches, coincidences connect the dates. As an estimated 2 billion people may watch the April 29th ritual of the future king and queen. An interesting article from Time Magazine from Henry Luce and Skull and Bones. Do the future king and queen need to hire a new wedding planner? the couple and their entourage spent weeks deciding on a wedding date, repeatedly liaising with officials at Buckingham Palace, No. 10 Downing Street, and Westminster Abbey. But amid all the chatter, no one had the sense to look up April 29 on Wikipedia. On that morning in 1945, Hitler married his longtime companion Eva Braun in Berlin. They killed themselves less than 40 hours later inside the Führerbunker. Kate's special day, that's Kate Middleton, who is marrying Prince William, the future king and possible antichrist. Kate's special day is associated with death and destruction in other ways, too. In 1970, the United States invaded Cambodia seeking to stop the flow of arms from North Vietnam to Viet Cong insurgents. The multi-prong offensive ultimately led to as many as 500,000 deaths. And in 1992, race riots broke out in Los Angeles following the acquittal of four white police officers seen beating motorist Rodney King on videotape. Widespread assaults, looting, murders, and robbery resulted in 53 deaths, thousands of injuries, and an estimated $1 billion in property damage. Not exactly happy occasions. Sure, that's all rather removed from Britain, but for Kate, a commoner marrying into royalty, April 29 has other associations closer to home that may stir discomfort, or at least snickers, from her detractors. On that day in 1986, the royal family buried Wallis Simpson, the Duchess of Windsor, and the wife of King Edward VIII, who abdicated the throne in order to marry her. Edward's relatives in his inner circle deemed Simpson, a twice-divorced American socialite, as wholly unsuitable for the king. Luckily, Queen Elizabeth has already expressed her approval of the fiancé formerly known as Wadey Katie. And while Kate's accent may sound posh to Americans, Britain's upper crust know all too well that she doesn't come from royal or even aristocratic lineage, that her parents, a former pilot and flight attendant, had to earn their money, reportedly, made Kate and her family the butt of jokes among William's friends. So it's a striking coincidence that My Fair Lady, the Broadway musical about a Cockney girl who strives to transform into a lady, premiered in London on this day, April 29th, 1958. It's not all bad news, though. Daniel Day-Lewis, Michelle Pfeiffer, and Jerry Seinfeld were born on April 29, and it's the day that American forces liberated the Dachau concentration camp. It also coincides with the feast day of an Italian saint from Siena. Her name? Catherine. As the royal ritual approaches, coincidences connect the dates.
Let's turn now to London, where date and location have been set for the royal wedding. Jeffrey Kaufman is at Buckingham Palace with the latest on this, Jeffrey. So we have the save the date, don't we?
We do. Book your tickets early, Robin. Friday, April 29th. We have a royal wedding, we have a wedding date, and we have a location, Westminster Abbey, the same place where Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip were married in 1947. Prince William and Kate Middleton will be married on Friday, April 29th at Westminster Abbey. And take a look behind me. You can see the royal standard flying above Buckingham Palace. That's because the Queen is in residence. The Queen is scheduled to leave with Prince Philip tomorrow for a five-day tour of the Gulf States. They didn't feel they could keep this secret for 5 days. They wanted to get the news out quickly. And one more thing, in these cost-conscious times here in Britain, the royal family has made it very clear that they and the Middletons will pay the entire cost of the wedding.
Taxpayers, I'm sure, are very happy to hear about that. Any particular reason why it's going to be on a Friday?
Well, it's very clear. This is a very big event, obviously. If you remember back to 1981, the storybook wedding of Charles and Diana, this is going to be a huge worldwide event. But here in the UK in particular, they're going to declare a national holiday, a bank holiday, and so they want to give people a long weekend to celebrate.
It will be a celebration. All right, Jeffrey, thank you very much. I know we'll be talking to you in the months ahead. Katie Nichol is going to join us now. She is the author of William and Harry Behind the Palace Walls, knows the royals very well, has been reporting on them for years, and she's there at Buckingham Palace now, and you have been out in front, one of the first to say the wedding would take place in 2011. When others were saying it was going to be this summer, you were like, it's going to be the spring. So what do you make of the date?
Well, like you say, I've been hearing for a while that it was going to be spring. I think the situation with Prince William and Catherine Middleton is they didn't want this to take too long. Let's remember, they've been together for nearly 9 years. They managed to keep this engagement a secret for so many weeks. I think they were just desperate to get the date, get it over and done with. But as I revealed in the paper last week, there were a lot of things that needed to be taken into account, government officials, other royal households. And I think it was getting to the point where we had to hear this morning that the date had been set because, of course, the Queen is off to the Gulf for her visit.
So they had, of course, check with with the Queen for the timing and that, but William has been insisting it's going to be his show to run, right? That he does not want Buckingham Palace to have all the say in this matter.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And we've just heard from the palace that Prince William sees this very much as his and Catherine Middleton's day. They have their own idea. They want to put their own stamp onto the wedding. They are going to have assistance from Buckingham Palace because for all the pomp and pageantry that happens, they will need it. But they want this very much to be their day, run very much by their own royal household at St. James's Palace.
And how much will her parents, her family, have involvement in this?
Actually, what they've said this morning is that they will be involved. I'm hearing that the Middletons are planning to host an engagement party. That, as you will know, is a breach of royal protocol. That thing doesn't usually happen. But in this instance, they're going to. They want Catherine to feel a part of this. And actually, we know that she's going to be taking a break from work and actually putting all of her efforts into planning this wedding. She's even got ideas at the moment for the table plan. So she is going to be, I suppose, like many brides out there, on top of her wedding day, very much.
She'll be very busy in the months ahead. And as you said, and as Jeffrey just reported, it's going to be a national holiday. People will take a long weekend. And again, people need to know that the royals and the Middletons are taking care of the cost of this. It's going to run into the millions, of course.
Well, I think that's a very important point to raise because, you know, it's also the Queen's Diamond Jubilee in 2012, and already we're hearing of plans to scale those celebrations down, and the same with this wedding. That said, it is a celebration. It is going to be their big day, and let's face it, the royal family are not short of a few pennies, so don't underestimate the sheer scale and exuberance of this wedding day. It's going to be wonderful. They've done it on a Friday. They wanted a spring wedding, and they wanted to give the whole country a day off.
And the Abbey has the space for 2,000 guests and the square out in front. It's going to be something to see. Katie, thank you, as always.
It will be.
We'll be talking to you again. Have a good day. Thank you, Katie.
There are so many angles to this that I am not prepared or versed to get into, but there are two great new articles from Tracy Twyman, who you may know and remember from being a recent guest on this show. QuintessentialPublications.com, or also TracyTwyman.com. Kings of the Apocalypse, secret end times message found encoded on Westminster Abbey coronation floor. When the next King of England is crowned, he will go through the same sacred ceremonies as his illustrious predecessors. Like them, just before being crowned, he will be anointed with oil from the Holy Land. This takes place under a canopy that is lowered over the monarch's head so that the public cannot see the actual moment of anointing. This goes on, but the part we want to mention is that next coronation is going to be even more special because it'll take place on top of a Masonic, or rather a mosaic, rather, representing the exact center of the cosmos and the end of time. That mosaic was created in 1268 by the command of King Henry III, but it has not been seen at the coronation for 150 years. It is called the Cosmati Pavement, and it has only been recently discovered. It was hiding under a carpet this entire time. Strangely, however, the same traditional spot for the coronation has continued to be used, just with the monarch and everybody else supposedly ignorant about what lay beneath his or her feet. It is now being restored so that the next king to reign will have the honor of standing upon it as the Holy Spirit enters into him. The other piece will come up first. Prince William marked for death with ominous sacrificial Beltane cake. Prince William and Kate Middleton would like you to believe that the date of their wedding was chosen for practical purposes pertaining to the social schedules of the participants, perhaps. According to the Time magazine article we just referenced, they spent weeks deciding on a date. And, of course, all the other coincidences that the article points out. What the article fails to point out is that April 29th is the eve of Walpurgis, the high holiday of pagan Europe, which is itself the eve of another pagan holiday, Beltane or May Day. May Day, of course, has the beatification of Pope John Paul II. So many events coming very soon down the pike, and again, we need help understanding all of these situations. So hopefully very soon we're going to get in touch with Tracy Twyman and discuss the royal ritual. The other couple of updates posted below this. One big street party for 4 days, says Piers Morgan, on the upcoming royal wedding. And in, you know, just a little related way, Prince Andrew may be quizzed as the FBI reopened the Jeffrey Epstein sex case. You may recall over the last several weeks we've been reporting briefly the Jeffrey Epstein sex case going on. And of course, it always connects the elites and blackmail. Another interesting piece on HolyHexes.com, making sense of Elizabeth Taylor's Jewish conversion. Yes, she was Jewish. This article takes the text from CNN, but buried within there are links to JewishJournal.com, ZOA.org, that's the Zionist Organization of America.org, KabbalisticNews.com, and SeraphicPress.com. Gets into all of these connections. That, again, so many things that I'm not versed enough to get into. And we thank, again, all the folks who are helping out and pitching in the Media Monarchy Kingdom. This coming from Steve in London, helping out on HolyHexes.com. Vigilant Citizen, one of the first articles published on that amazing site, which you may know from getting into the occult rituals of music video award shows and all your favorite pop videos from Gaga and Kanye. But one of the first articles published on Vigilant Citizen was called Sinister Sites, St. John the Divine Cathedral, where they go into the building's occult symbolism and its role in the United Nations effort to push a single world religion. This cathedral is in New York, as is the United Nations, with its land donated by the Rockefellers. The article has a ton of photos, which I did not reproduce, on Holy Hexes that get into possible predictive programming and prophecy of the destruction of the Twin Towers. And, of course, we've always seen 9/11 in our media, placed in our consciousness with the emergency line and then showing up in The Simpsons and Traffic and Lone Gunman and all of those places. But I digress. Are these the nails from the crucifixion? New Israeli film claims discovery of nails from Jesus' cross.
A sensational new claim by an Emmy Award-winning filmmaker has reignited debate over archaeology, the Bible, and profiting from claims about Jesus. Alice Marquardt is in Tel Aviv to sort through fact, fiction, and salesmanship.
Jesus' crown of thorns, the pieces of his cross, the cloth that covered his body when he died. For years, the world has wondered, are they holy relics or fragments of a faithful imagination? Now, added to that list is a new story being spun by this man, Simcha Yakubovich, an award-winning Israeli filmmaker. He believes there's strong evidence that the nails that pinned Jesus to the cross have survived. He makes the case in a documentary which he sold to the History Channel.
How sure are you that these are the nails used in Jesus' crucifixion?
What I'm sure about is that they're significant. They were found in the tomb of a man known to history for one thing and one thing only, and that is sending Jesus to Pontius Pilate, who sends him to the cross.
Yakubovich says the two Roman-made nails were found in a tomb, believed by some to be the final resting place of Caiaphas, a Jewish high priest that the Gospels say gave Jesus up to the Romans.
Israel's Antiquities Authority says the tomb could very well have belonged to someone else, and that nails are commonly found in coffins from the period, used to inscribe the names of the deceased.
Look at this.
Yakubovich argues the evidence is strong that these nails were for a crucifixion.
They're bent, which suggests they were bent so you can't pull your hand out of the wood. The head is big enough, and it corresponds perfectly to the only nail we know for sure was used in a crucifixion.
A leap of faith.
I think the story here is, nails of the cross found? ? But it's a damn important question.
Certainly an intriguing one. Alex Marquardt, ABC News, Tel Aviv.
It's a damn important question. But they don't look like 9-inch nails to me. That film is called The Nails of the Cross. And of course, it's just in time for Easter. France starts ban on full face veil. This story from Faith World we go into on the latest episode of NewWorldNextWeek.com. We also have the updates on now fines being issued, and of course the suspicious site intelligence center, the search for international terrorist extremists online with their connection to Zionist organizations. We go into this story on NewWorldNextWeek.com, so I will not repeat the text for you. I implore you to go to YouTube.com/Korber Report and check out and share and comment and thumb up the latest episode of New World Next Week. But we do have an update in the form of a clip as France starts the ban on the full face veil.
In France, women are now officially banned from wearing full-face veils in public after a controversial law came into effect. While the government says the move is aimed at helping Muslims adapt to the local community, critics accuse President Sarkozy of persecuting Islam to win back votes from the right. But in a country with Europe's biggest Muslim population, the law risks igniting social tensions, as Daniel Bushell reports.
Pin has just become a criminal. From today, a new French law bans covering your face in public. It's designed to make Muslim women integrate in society. But the softly spoken single mom says it's had the opposite effect.
My friends have simply stopped going out at all.
The new rulings made some scared to speak out, but many vow not to change the way they dress. The move undermines what the French Republic stands for, says this businessman. He pledges to pay the €150 fine for anyone who continues to wear a veil and is taking the dispute further.
We are suing France in the European Court of Human Rights. It's about freedom of expression.
Abderrahman Dahman was fired as Nicolas Sarkozy's integration advisor last month after criticizing the president's approach. He now calls on French Muslims to wear a star similar to the one forced on Jews by the Nazis.
This government should learn how to negotiate.
Opinion polls show record low approval ratings for the French government, with accusations it's deliberately stirring interracial tension.
Friday prayers in Paris. Muslims are forced to worship on the street. The government blocks the building of basic public prayer rooms. More discrimination, say worshippers, against the Muslim population.
France has seen riots in recent years against government policies. There are signs of more brewing.
It is a distinct possibility, especially when the domestic decisions and events and foreign decisions and events come together.
Those foreign events have also outraged partners in Europe. Jenning blames France's illegal deportation of Roma and sending North African refugees back to Italy in the face of international anger. That splits the Franco-German axis that drives the EU.
This axis, as it has been called sometimes, is not functioning.
Analysts fear France can no longer lecture Muslim regimes when it picks on its own ethnic minorities.
Why should we stop persecuting Christians if you are persecuting Muslims, saying you have absolutely no credibility or reliability to tell us what we should do?
But cracks are forming within the French government over its hardline policies. Several high-profile politicians in the ruling UMP party last week quit. More are expected to do the same in the coming days. Daniel Bushell, RT, Paris.
Continuing on holyhexes.com, Atheist publishes Secular Bible. From CNN, what if the book that billions have turned to for ethical guidance wasn't tied to commandments from God or any one particular tradition, but instead included the writings of Aristotle, the reflections of Confucius, the poetry of Baudelaire? What would that book look like and what would it mean? Decades after he started asking such questions, what A.C. Grayling calls a lifetime's work has hit bookshelves. The Good Book, a humanist Bible subtitled A Secular Bible in the UK, was published this month. Grayling crafted it by using more than 1,000 texts representing several hundred authors, collections, and traditions. The Bible would have been a very different book and may have produced a very different history for mankind had it drawn on the work of philosophers and writers as opposed to prophets and apostles, says Grayling, a philosopher and professor at Birkbeck College, University of London, who is an atheist. Like the Bible, the Good Book opens with a garden scene. But instead of Adam and Eve, Grayling's Genesis invokes Isaac Newton, the British scientist who pioneered the study of gravity. The book's final chapter features a secular, humanist version of the Ten Commandments. Love well, seek the good in all things, harm no others, think for yourself, take responsibility, respect nature, do your utmost, be informed, be kind, be courageous, at least sincerely try. We would note that, of course, Yoda says there is no try. And I would also note that secular humanism is another phrase I first heard on the spoken word tapes of Jello Biafra. But our final post on holyhexes.com is the 414 pop culture list of headlines, invasion, eviction, investigation. From the religious news agency, think you'll need last rites? you better plan ahead. I believe just as we've noted the rise in the belief in the need for exorcisms due to films about exorcisms, this seems directly correlated. An interesting two-part article on GodDiscussion.com, a site that we do get a lot of our sources for Holy Hexes from, The Second Coming of Jesus and the Space Alien Tactical Invasion of Planet Earth. Part 1, How Should We Respond? Part 2, What Should Governments Be Doing? This concerns, of course, the Project Bluebeam, the fake rapture, the War of the Worlds psychological operation that they seem to be preparing us for on every level. 21 Californian trailer park residents evicted to make way for Scientology golf course. That's from the Daily Mail. Meanwhile, the Westboro Baptist Church network of websites is back up after the anonymous hack attack. CNN press room asking what happened in Waco. CNN presents Waco, Faith, Fear, and Fire. One of the numerous things that swirl around this time, right now, when, yes, Mercury is in retrograde, this is not the time to start a new life, this is not the time to sign a lease. Mercury is in retrograde from March 30th to April 23rd. So many of the events, Waco, Oklahoma City, Columbine, Hitler, all of them seem to surround this time. And as we said at the close of last week's show, it was no great prophetic feat, but we accurately said, watch for all the mass murder contagion memes going on in the coming week. And we'll get to that in just a little bit when we discuss murder and mayhem. Explosion outside that California synagogue is, at first, said accidental. And you may recall we reported that for you several weeks ago, as we track some of the smaller stories that fall off the front page for you. But again, we read it all into the record here and put it out worldwide. The explosion outside that California synagogue is now being called intentional, and they have a blast suspect to be charged with murderous intent. More on that from the Jerusalem Post and National Terror Alert. And has Madonna ditched Kabbalah for Opus Dei? UK tabloid The Mirror speculating on the possibility that the Malawi disaster with Madonna and Kabbalah being a huge money sink and possible money laundering operation, just as so many of our well-meaning humanitarian efforts led by well-meaning, useful idiot celebrities so many times are. They do report that Madonna has had meetings with Opus Dei, so, you know, one elite-connected secret society to another. So, speaking of, there was a book from Jeffrey Toobin. I believe it's been out for a while, but again, GodDiscussion.com, making note of The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. And again, The Nine is quite the interesting title. Apparently, a poll from Sports Illustrated says that football fans would go to church and surf the internet if the upcoming NFL season was canceled. And a hilarious video. The audio wouldn't do too much for you, but you got to see Bob Larson casting out a homosexual demon. And the way we end our holy hexes from DailyGrail.com, new study published in the Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease investigates mediumship. That's right. Scientific journal posting papers on contacting the dead. Clyde Lewis of GroundZeroMedia.org would call it the Edison box. And one of the most interesting books I have on my bookshelf at home is called Haunted Media. And why do you think we watch media and the seances were a medium connecting spiritualism to poltergeist to the radio waves and all of those things? Again, the Haunted Media is quite an interesting read. A few moments before hour two, my friend, so I'll go ahead and take the moment right now to tell you it's April 15th, 2011. This is episode 214 of MediaMonarchy.com. My name's James Evan Pilato, your host and webmaster of the site and show MediaMonarchy.com, coming to you live, as always, from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, zeropointradio.com, revereradio.net, frolympia.org, berkeleyliberationradio.net, and so many other fantastic alternative media outlets. Thank you for spreading the word and rebroadcasting and helping Media Monarchy. We now move to cyberspacewar.com for all the latest in inner and outer space, and we'll begin with the latest DEF CON list of headlines: opt-out botnet and fake book revolutions. Threat level reporting that a new law would let you opt out of online web tracking. I'm sure it'll be just like you can opt out of the naked body scanners. Private records of 3.5 million people exposed by Texas. That is from Reuters, and again from threat level. In a surprise appeal, the TJX hacker now claims the U.S. authorized his crimes, as he was a, quote, key undercover Secret Service informant. Ah, see, yet again. He was part of an ongoing intelligence operation. And the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. The AFP, in a roundabout way, getting into fake book revolutions and people-powered coups as U.S. trains activists to evade security forces. With an actual court order, the FBI hijacks the Core Flood botnet and sends the kill signal. In another precedent-setting move, many more to come, I believe. Macworld.com, police increasingly peeping at email and instant messages. PC World reporting Chinese far outstripped a U.S. cyber spy fight for military and business secrets. Rhode Island lawmakers look at law to school cyberbullying. That's from the Boston Globe. Dozens apply for space pilot jobs at Virgin Galactic. And the Kochab star in The Little Dipper is about to go supernova. The last supernova in our neighborhood was observed by Galileo in 1604. And that is again from GodDiscussion.com. I cram so much into these episodes. I work very hard to cram so much in. I'm cramming in info right up until the time I leave the house to come to the station. And here is just such a case, and like so many other times, it hits the nail right on the head, right when it needed to be hit.
It's the Onion Radio News. The director of the FBI wishes he had some alien thing to cover up. This is Doyle Redland reporting. Tired of focusing on counterfeiting operations and unsubstantiated homeland security threats, FBI Director Robert Mueller publicly admitted today that he wishes he had some exciting alien thing to cover up.
I know the work I do is important and necessary, but after a long day of reading 450-page reports, I really wish I could order a sweeping cover-up of reverse-engineered UFO technology.
Mueller added that it would be cool just to see a real spaceman. Doyle Redland for the Onion Radio News, online at theonion.com.
Furthermore, on cyberspacewar.com, just a few days ago, we had the 50th anniversary of the first man in space. And we have links to, again, goddiscussion.com and Wikipedia and newsahead.com. Russian cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin blasted off aboard Vostok 1 on April 12, 1961, to become the first man in space. The event proved a second political coup for the Soviet Union. The communists had put Sputnik, the first satellite, in orbit. And let's check out a condensed version of Gagarin's story in just 34 seconds.
The first man in space, Yuri Gagarin, is trending on the 50th anniversary of his maiden space flight. The 27-year-old cosmonaut spent 108 minutes in orbit before landing on April 12, 1961. Gagarin's flight spurred the international space race between the United States and the Soviet Union, leading President John F. Kennedy to set the goal of being the first to land on the moon.
We choose to go to the moon!
7 years after Gagarin's first journey into space, he was killed on a routine training flight. Gagarin's Gagarin's pioneering legacy is remembered at Star City, Moscow's oldest spaceflight training facility.
Now, my man Alan in Omaha, the main writer and editor now over at cyberspacewar.com, he puts far more into it than I do, which again, as I said, is hopefully my plan, that we can build this network of sites and then hand out the keys to the kingdom and we can all help run the monarchy. But 2 days before the Google Doodle let everyone, including myself, know that it was the 50th anniversary of the first man in space, Alan was ahead of the curve. 2 days before that, he posted on cyberspacewar.com on Vladimir Ilyushin, the real first man in space. On the brink of the 50th anniversary, Yuri Gagarin is celebrated as first man in space. Gagarin, a handsome test pilot, remains the face of a Russian and Soviet first over Cold War rival the U.S. The 5-foot-2-inch cosmonaut received Hero of the Soviet Union Award, its highest honor. A sympathetic character, Gagarin came from humble origins, Klushnikov, a country village. Just outside Moscow, a training facility was named after Gagarin following his death in a 1968 plane crash. Was Yuri Gagarin the first man in space aboard Vostok 1 on April 12, 1961? The sad truth is a far more fitting candidate, Vladimir Ilyushin. Ilyushin, son of a Russian aircraft designer and a famous test pilot, was in reality 5 days earlier the first. Ilyushin's flight went badly, however, and he came down in China. The real first man in space spent the next year in a Chinese hospital before his return. A YouTube video, The Cosmonaut Cover-Up, provides Vladimir Ilyushin's story. And this is another case where the truth always makes for a far more interesting story. Vladimir Ilyushin, the first real man in space. And the first episode on the new station, 5 nights a week, my man Clyde Lewis of groundzeromedia.org picked up 5 nights a week on KXL 101.1 FM and 750 AM here in Portland, Oregon and beyond. I was able to steal away a few moments so I could listen to the very beginning of Clyde's first new show. And something he mentioned there made it to cyberspacewar.com with another excellent breakdown provided by my man Alan in Omaha. We discussed this story on the latest New World next week, but we did it with maybe the easier Guardian newspaper version. But the breakdown that James Corbett provides so well, I'll try and reiterate here in article form. In 1995, 10 million Americans watched the alien autopsy. But producer Ray Santilli admits there were only two or three authentic frames of the aliens. The remainder of the film was staged. This week's Daily Mail headline provides an echo of the past with "The Memo That Proves Aliens Landed at Roswell, Released Online by the FBI," a sensational headline designed to draw readers. You can view the memo with links for you, where someone does the navigation for you on a video. The memo is at the FBI website under a subdomain called The Vault. And is this what the internet has come to? Self-serve disinfo? Nancy Atkinson, a Universe Today writer, provides a more accurate assessment in FBI memo does not prove aliens crash landed in Roswell. While the memo is genuine, it is not new, is not secret, having been released in 1976 by the FBI and a third-hand account from Agent Guy Hotel reporting what an Air Force investigator was told by an informant. It's disconcerting the FBI memo is presented as breaking news. It's clearly deceptive. Is it setting the stage for an alien psychological operation? Our aforementioned Bluebeam, fake rapture, War of the Worlds-style event. You can read the opinions of veteran UFO researchers in a previous post on cyberspacewar.com, getting into folks like William Cooper, who came to believe aliens are mostly a psyop, a means towards a one-world government, such that Nazi Wernher von Braun even noted. The related post comes from the Guardian article that we cite in episode 69 of NewWorldNextWeek.com. FBI destroyed thousands of UFO reports. Furthermore, on Cyberspace War, and as if to hopefully hammer in illusions and hoaxes, the Great Moon Hoax of 1835, the New York Sun, founded in 1833 as a penny paper press, catered to a wide audience with a narrative style and a cheaper price. On August 25, 1835, the first of six articles appeared in the paper that became known collectively as the Great Moon Hoax, showing supposed inhabitants of the moon. The Museum of Hoaxes website gets into a full treatment at museumofhoaxes.com. We'll also make a quick note about Philip K. Dick's story, The Adjustment Team, which you may know from the new Matt Damon film, The Adjustment Bureau. Apparently, the story fell out of copyright, but to play it safe, they altered the title a little bit. But it wouldn't be the first time that Dick's work has been mangled into a mainstream film. Something we wanted to note last week, because now the concerts have actually taken place, and we even referenced it in my intro, the concert odyssey that we didn't have time for last week. From Reuters, Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey made the timpani intro of Richard Strauss's Thus Sprach Zarathustra a cliché for a dramatic entrance, and the crescendo of Grigori Ligeti's Atmospheres a cult classic. Now fans of one of the most influential soundtracks of all time can hear it in a sound that will out Dolby Dolby for an ambitious program at London's South Bank Center that combines a new print of Kubrick's 1968 sci-fi masterpiece with a large chorus and a full orchestra playing the music live. It's absolute goosebumps, said Gillian Moore, head of contemporary culture at South Bank, where two concert showings of 2001 were given on April 7th and 8th. It's like an opera. I would say it's the perfect marriage of sound, theater, drama, and visual art.
Millions of years ago, before the human race existed, an adventure began. An adventure that ultimately leads man to confront his own destiny in an odyssey of exploration.
Here's what started the whole thing.
We thought it might be the upper part of some buried structure, so we excavated out on all sides.
And what's more, it seems to have been deliberately buried.
A shrieking monolith, deliberately buried by an alien intelligence, starts man on a mission half a billion miles into space. With three of its five crew asleep in hibernation, spacecraft Discovery 1 voyages towards Jupiter. Controlling the mission is a talking computer known as HAL.
HAL, you're the brain and central nervous system of the ship. Does this ever cause you any lack of confidence?
Let me put it this way, Mr. Aimer. No 9,000 computer has ever made a mistake or distorted information.
In the first year of the 21st century, there is strange and wondrous beauty, startling experiences that jolt and mystify, and the danger of complete obliteration.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
And now, your journey is just beginning.
Stanley Kubrick, 2001. Of course, one of our most illuminated filmmakers. Our last couple bits on cyberspacewar.com. Are four minds melted into mumbling gibberish statistically significant? A Mail Online article questions, are U.S. government microwave mind control tests causing TV presenters' brains to melt down? One theory gaining popularity online, according to the article, blames the U.S. military's supposed research into using microwaves as a mind control weapon. Proponents say the effects produced by microwave signals stimulating the brain with fake images and voices exactly mimic those displayed in the recent on-air breakdowns. The four cases are dismissed as migraines for Serene Branson, which we covered on this show. And then there have been three more events that we have not covered. Mark McAllister, a seizure for Sarah Carlson, and no diagnosis yet on Judge Judy. There's a vague awareness that something is amiss. Four cases may make even the most casual observers ask questions. An article from Pat Dollard adds the observation that in times of unrest, the government always likes to make the opposition unable to speak. And what of Jared Loughner? Tim Riffitt, an expert on psychic warfare, provides an education with his microwave mind control page on the Educate Yourself website. Riffitt observes networks of transmitters to beam mind control signals into the brains of anyone living near these transmitters. Microwave phones use pulse-modulated microwaves of the correct intensity to pass through the skull into the brain and control behavior. If they can blast sound into your brain from a advertisement in Times Square, if they can project holographic images in the sky, is it Black Ops military microwaving media minds? We can only speculate, and we are only speculating. Another interesting angle to this that my man Clyde mentioned was somehow a return to what the Tower of Babel did to man in the Bible. We reach too high, try to build a tower to reach God, so he said, I'll knock you all down and mess up your languages. Now none of you can talk to each other. Ha 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 ha. Our final note on cyberspacewar.com is an intriguing question. Is the Japan elite hiding secret weapons programs in nuclear plants? Environmental writer Yoichi Shimatsu provides keen insight on Japan's disaster in the article, Is Japan's Elite Hiding a Weapons Program Inside Nuclear Plants? A casual observer of the calamity cannot help but compare Japan's inept response to the U.S. government's similar ineffective efforts in Katrina. Shimatsu comments, inexplicable delays and half-baked explanations from TEPCO and the Ministry of Economy seem to be driven by some unspoken factor. There is an unsettling lack of response, just as in the Hurricane Katrina disaster. Why? The most logical explanation? The nuclear industry and government agencies are scrambling to prevent the discovery of atomic bomb research facilities hidden inside Japan's civilian nuclear power plants. Again, only speculation. There are links, and you can listen to an interview with Yoichi Shimatsu on the Japan disaster. And again, that article comes from newamericamedia.org. And that closes up all our updates from all the other sites in the kingdom. And for the remainder of this show, we will be on the flagship site of MediaMonarchy.com, where we will segue quite easily to our latest Japan crisis updates and the related BioWars and EnviroHealth headlines. And it's not good. From The Guardian, Japan upgrades nuclear crisis now to the same level and rating of Chernobyl. Meanwhile, 1 month to the day, Japan was hit with a 7.1 magnitude quote-unquote aftershock.
Northeastern Japan was shaking again, a month after a massive earthquake and tsunami killed up to 25,000 people in the country's worst disaster since World War II. The strong aftershock frightened people and triggered a tsunami alert, but no major damage was reported and the warning about a giant wave was canceled in about an hour. Still, power was knocked out to some 200,000 households. Operators of Japan's stricken Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant said Monday's aftershock did briefly cut electricity to the facility, and they pulled workers out for a short time as well as a precaution. Officials said operations weren't endangered, however. Still, the government urged people in five communities outside the mandatory 20-kilometer evacuation zone to leave because of the risk of radiation contamination. And people elsewhere have concerns about that, too. In the capital, housewife Kaori Asai voiced them.
Things like this worry me if it keeps happening. I don't want to live my life worrying about the radiation effect on my child all the time.
Earlier, people in the hard-hit region had paused to remember the exact moment the devastating 9.0 magnitude quake had rocked the ground back on March 11th. As sirens blared, people bowed their heads and stood in silence. In Tokyo, members of the cabinet, including Prime Minister Naoto Kan, did so as well.
It has been 1 month since the quake happened. I hereby conduct a silent prayer to express our sincere condolences for the souls killed in the disasters.
In Kesanuma City in Miyagi Prefecture, members of Japan's Self-Defense Force have been carrying out a painstaking search for victims since the third day after the tsunami wiped out the town. Officials said 700 people there have been confirmed dead, but crews continue to hunt for traces of twice that number still missing. The regimental commander says it's a difficult task, as his forces need to use heavy equipment to move the rubble, yet they want to take care not to damage any bodies they find. And there's no end in sight for their task. Karen Sloan, The Associated Press.
Meanwhile, a disturbing bit of eerie footage from inside Japan's radioactive evacuation zone. A guy basically goes in to video and document the bizarre horror film-like atmosphere of a desolated area, with strange packs of animals roaming around, and so much more is in there. Meanwhile, from the IntelHub.com that has been doing a fantastic job tracking our nuclear world now, our radioactive world, as we said, get active or get radioactive. I guess we're going to have to do both. Japan nuclear radiation found in food bought in California stores. Meanwhile, thousands march in a Japan anti-nuke protest.
The explosion at the Japanese nuclear power plant has given new fuel to a long-running dispute in Germany, where tens of thousands demonstrated on Saturday against plans to extend the life of the country's nuclear power stations. According to the police, some 50,000 people took part in the protest, which saw a human chain spread from a nuclear power plant in Neckarwestheim to the city of Stuttgart. Those participating in the demonstration said it was time for the German government to move away from nuclear power. German Chancellor Angela Merkel, whose government has extended the lifespan of Germany's nuclear power plants, was set to meet senior cabinet ministers later on Saturday in light of fears of a meltdown in Japan.
You can get more on that from Raw Story and Raw Replay. The last update I have from a few days ago from NHK out of Japan: temperatures rise at the number 4 spent fuel storage pool. And let's see, if we look at Google News right now on this April 15th morning, the top stories are cluster bomb, Charlie Sheen, Gaddafi, Google. Nothing about our radioactive world. Let's tie in our other BioWars and EnviroHealth updates. The loud rumbling noise in Florida that we reported for you recently, is it similar to the loud rumbling noise that preceded the seeming disappearance of a village in China? More on that strange story from thebigwobble.com. And so many of our stories, whether we're talking about space or God or religion or royal rituals and all of these things, are becoming more strange. I don't believe that in my time running Media Monarchy that I've gotten more and more far out there as the site and show went on, that I needed to go larger and crazier and get to the fringes. If anything, the longer I do it, in a way, I try and make it as kind of simple, and it's difficult to even use the word conservative because that word is loaded to mean something else now. I downplay some of the things to not beat people over the head. I run the sites and I design the sites and I link up and work on it in a somewhat subtle way and add the extra supplemental links in there for you. And you can dig if you decide to go deeper. The links are there. The times have become quite strange. I don't believe I'm looking for it. Meanwhile, a 4.2 magnitude quake hit Arkansas. That's from News9.com. And we can look at the opening news as well and see about those tornadoes that we referenced at the top of the show in Arkansas, in Oklahoma. And we again make reference to possible massive earth change events happening in the New Madrid Fault area around Arkansas. Not to mention our own Pacific Northwest area. Good God. Meanwhile, from bioprepwatch.com, Ohio County simulates a bio attack. Why would we have to simulate any of these attacks? They're happening for real, but of course the measurements just aren't working correctly. Johnson & Johnson fined for bribing doctors. They agree to pay $70 million to settle the charges. More on that from Raw Story and AllGov. And a story that happened two Thursdays ago, but we did not report for you last week on episode 213. But here it is, and we've asked the question. The fluoride spill at an Illinois water facility requires complete hazmat response, but it's okay to drink.
First tonight, hazmat crews from all across our area responded to a chemical leak this afternoon in Rock Island. The chemical was so strong that it was burning through the concrete there. News 8's Christy Mergenthal has the latest.
It was just before 1 o'clock Thursday afternoon when hazmat crews were called to the Rock Island Water Treatment Plant for a chemical spill coming from this tanker truck.
It's a corrosive agent that the water treatment plant uses, and there was an overflow that caused spillage out from the building onto this driveway behind me.
As plant employees evacuated, crews began suiting up, working quickly to stop the leak that had begun eating through concrete.
And they stopped the leak using some earthen berms with dirt, sand, and some commercial boom equipment. And had it contained pretty much to this facility within a short amount of time.
The chemical hydrofluorosilicic acid is used to add fluoride to the plant's water. Although it poses a burn risk to skin, those living nearby were in no immediate danger.
There was no inhalation hazard at all, so there was no need for us to evacuate any residents around the area.
After several hours, crews were able to clean up the leak, allowing operations to return to normal.
They had to cordon off the area, obviously, but as far as the treatment of the water and the amount of water being used by the public, there's no effect on that at all.
In Rock Island, Christy Mergenthal, WQAD Quad Cities, News 8.
Thank you, Christy. Investigators tonight still haven't given an official estimate on just how much of that chemical spilled out.
Now, my friends, our next story we cover on the latest episode of NewWorldNextWeek.com, episode 69, on Radioactive America and the Fashion Police and the FBI's UFOs. Here's the Radioactive America. U.S. unprepared for nuclear emergency. Nuke officials worry about their plans despite public assurances. The federal agency charged with ensuring the nation's security against disasters admitted last year in a confidential report that the U.S. is ill-prepared to deal with a significant release of radiation. Now, again, we've already covered that on New World Next Week, so I won't get into it here. We cover it quite extensively there, and the links are all provided for you to flesh out this story, and we provide the PDF for you to download from the Department of Heartland Security. So, having quickly brushed over Radioactive America, we now reach the 414 news purge on MediaMonarchy.com. We call it state-run radio, and we take that title from our opening track that we heard at the top of this episode from Lupe Fiasco and Self. And we're going to need about every moment of the half hour remaining in this show. Okay, here we go. 414 news purge. Buckle up. We'll begin with 9/11 updates. Evidence, quote-unquote, against 9/11 plotters revealed. That's from Raw Story. Military prosecutors compare Native American resistance to Al-Qaeda, and that's not going on very well. And, of course, this surrounding the fact that we're going to now try these guys in Guantanamo who have been tortured for years and who've admitted to doing all kinds of things they never could have been able to do, but they are the patsies in this phony Orwellian system where Al-Qaeda means the database of Mujahideen fighters that we have on the intelligence agency's black op payroll. The Extraordinary Conflict of Interest story has gone quite viral in the last several days. Bush's cousin is a judge in the explosive case against Bush administration officials. Architect tells Muncie, Indiana crowd, controlled demolition felled the towers. That's a regional news report about Richard Gage on tour with architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth. That comes from NWITimes.com out of Indiana. An amazing piece on 911blogger.com, the many false hijackings of 9/11. You didn't know that up to 29 hijackings were reported, but of course, they were running drills of the exact same things happening at the exact same time, and false blips were put on the screens of the air traffic controllers, and that's why you can hear them on all the recordings saying, "Is this live? Is this a drill? I think that's a damn input." And we end our 9/11 updates with two bad notes. First responder death toll nears 1,000. That's from intrepidreport.com. And we end with an update from just this morning from Courthouse News. Airlines and airport security agree to pay $1.2 billion for 9/11 property damages. That would be the damage of the World Trade Center buildings. Do you know who owns those? Lucky Larry Silverstein, the guy that owns the Chicago Sears, that is Willis Tower, the city that will now be governed by the Mossad mayor. We move to EconoCrash as Emancipation Day drives federal tax deadline, which would be today, my friends, April 15th here in the States, where we pay our questionably constitutional income taxes. Emancipation Day has driven the deadline to the 18th, or this coming Monday. Watch how I hurry. World economists urge G20 to accept a Robin Hood tax. That is very good news from The Guardian. Taxing derivatives. We could pretty much feed the world with the crumbs that the gangsters and banksters and oligarchs brush off for each other in all their phony, fake derivative transactions. The economy is booming again, but for CEOs. Meanwhile, Wells Fargo tests microchip credit cards for globe-trotting clients. That's right, you're not in the club. That's from Bloomberg. Meanwhile, Obama signs temporary spending bill. That's from the Deutsche Press Agency. The Daily Bell reporting that little Iceland panics big banks. Meanwhile, girls in Georgia, that is in the United States, were robbed of the $150 they had made at their lemonade stand trying to sell lemonade for a sick friend. Didn't know where to put that in an Econo Crash or Murder and Mayhem or what. Meanwhile, Travel.AOL's reporting on the British banker dies in plunge from Singapore hotel rooftop bar, and that's this week's installment in the bankster death pool that piles up by the week. And why wouldn't it? Bloomberg reports suicide rates in U.S. increase as economy declines, CDC researchers find. And it would have been the only note on drug war updates, so I just included it at the bottom of our EconoCrash updates because it's all quite fitting, because the one and only Max Keiser notes that the global banking system runs entirely on coke.
Now, I remember, let me tell you something, Casey. I remember this very vividly when I was working on Wall Street in 1980. Every Friday, we used to have cocktails on Park Avenue and watch this parade of limousines travel down Park Avenue into the basement of Citibank. Everyone knew this was money that was being laundered by Citibank from drug money. This was an open secret. Nobody doubted it. So I'm glad to see now, at least 25 years later, people are beginning to understand that the global finance community, the global banking system, runs entirely on cocaine money. So they say, well, why is the war on drugs failing? Because they need the cash to run the bank. Why is the drug problem so rampant around the world? Because bankers need that money to pay their bonuses. The bankers, when we say bankers are terrorists, they kill people, and they have the moral equivalency of a Mexican drug lord lopping the head off a baby to support their crime syndicate. That's what we need. They're the same. They're the same two faces of the same coin. They're terrorists. Blankfein, Diamond, Jose, whomever, drug lord, they're all terrorists. They all revolve around cocaine and money laundering, and now we know unequivocally, based on Gretchen Morgenson's report and others, Wachovia Bank, of course, Warren Buffett's not involved with that. Who knows what Charlie Munger's habit is? The guy must be a horse.
So what it takes documentaries and books, hours and hours and thousands of pages to do, somebody like Max Keiser can break it down in a second. Drugs fund Wall Street. Period. We move to geopolitics, where Pakistan says the U.S. must sharply cut the CIA activities. Yeah, they're kind of getting mighty tired of innocents being killed by drones and furthermore. But, you know, the ISI was set up with the help of the CIA, as Daniel Pearl was finding out. U.S. continues airstrikes in Libya. Meanwhile, the EU prepares ground troops for Libya. Medvedev warns of Libyan collapse. Will consult with China on the possible response. That is from Bloomberg. That is their headline. As we noted, it's all leading to China and Russia. Syrian soldiers shot for refusing to fire on protesters. That's from The Guardian. And a funny video that made the rounds on the lookout is the president of the Czech Republic, a pen stealer. Funny footage of him kind of pocketing a pen, whether or not he was supposed to, at a big press conference. Mubarak's son is held as the Egyptian leader himself collapses with heart problems. Mubarak has heart attack during questioning. More on that from the Daily Mail and of Goats and Men. And isn't it quite convenient? Every time trouble seems to swirl around for Mubarak, he has a heart attack and is taken away. Dramatic footage shows troops capturing Ivory Coast's former president. Shillery says the capture is a lesson to dictators everywhere. That's from Haaretz. And InfoWars and Raw Story getting into the video and the United Nations installing a new IMF stooge in the Ivory Coast. And two headlines from early this morning that we updated to this 414 News Purge state-run radio. Al-Qaeda Al-Zawahiri surfaces in a rare online video. And, of course, you can get that on NationalTerrorAlert.com. As well, 16 Mexico police officers held, accused of aiding cartels in massacres. That's how it works. Drugs. Our murder and mayhem is disgustingly overflowing, my friends. Lone gunman shoots six dead in a Dutch shopping mall.
A mall shooting shocks this Dutch town south of Amsterdam. Lone gunman Tristan van der Vlie opened fire at this shopping center, killing six and injuring at least 10 others Saturday. Children were among those injured. After wreaking havoc with a machine gun, eyewitnesses said the shooter turned a pistol on himself. They described their terror as gunfire and screaming rang through the mall.
A man was carrying a machine gun. I ran back inside and closed the door and the shutters. He recharged his gun's ammunition and continued shooting and walking. It is really horrible, overwhelming.
The public prosecutor said the 24-year-old had a license for five guns and owned three. Van der Vlie was investigated in 2003 on suspicion he violated weapons laws, but was not convicted. Bomb squads were called in after a suicide note found in his car said he had placed explosives in three other malls. The malls were evacuated, but no explosives were found. The young man's two suicide notes did not reveal the motive behind his violent rampage. Lindsay Perietti, Reuters.
Two suicide notes? Dutch town in shock after gunman's rampage. Furthermore, on murder and mayhem, was there a Satanism connection to the fact that a South African couple kept a head in their refrigerator? Meanwhile, a deadly blast hits Belarus, and you can watch the amazing clip and just thank God you're not on it yourself, as an Air France jumbo jet clips and spins quite dramatically a smaller commuter jet. An update from earlier this morning, U.S. air traffic controllers asleep on the job, the director resigns. That was from the Deutsche Press agency. So is this. Woman raped in Denver airport. As our airports get worse and worse and worse by the moment. Again, seeming to be the idea that nobody wants to travel, just stay inside. We mentioned the escaped cobra meme from the Bronx Zoo last week, just to get it into the record and all of our strange animal stories. Well, the update from ABC News is that the Bronx Zoo announces that cobra's name. It's Mia, or M-I-A, for missing in action, which of course makes me think of the musician M-I-A, who I've mentioned on this show I've had dreams about bad endings for whatever reason. Congress slips anti-wolf rule into the budget bill, the first ever intervention with the Endangered Species Act, and that does concern Oregon. Boy escapes as mother kills self and three kids in a New York drowning suicide. The 10th set of human remains in New York point to a serial killer. That is again from the Deutsche Press Agency, but from the underrated Newsy.com, they point out that the New York serial killer could be a cop.
Police continue to search for a possible serial killer who dumped bodies along a New York beach. And now, new evidence has law enforcement wondering, is the killer one of their own? First to our original report of the story.
Police say Shannon Gilbert, a prostitute from New Jersey, went missing about a year ago. In December, investigators searching for Gilbert found four bodies. Then last week, one more. And Monday, three more, all around a popular beach on Long Island where Gilbert was last seen.
Since then, two more bodies have been found in the same area, 10 total and possibly all related. A frightening scenario made even scarier by the profile detectives are creating on the killer. They say whoever did this appears to have an extensive knowledge of the area and police technology and could be a cop.
All four of the prostitutes who were killed and dumped on Oak Beach in Long Island were all called on disposable cell phones that were not traceable. And those calls were all made from very crowded areas. We're talking about places like Madison Square Garden and Times Square. The theory being, even if they could pinpoint the time that this call was actually made, it would be impossible to have surveillance video pick that man out.
The New York Times reports taunting phone calls were also made to one victim's family, a teenage sister. But another trick of the trade kept those two from being traced. The caller kept each of his vulgar, mocking, and insulting calls to less than 3 minutes. One investigator said the brief duration of the calls thwarted efforts by the New York Police Department to use the signal to pinpoint the caller's location and find him. All this led NBC to point out a striking comparison with another well-known serial killer.
Evasive measures to make tracking and tracing futile, reports suggest.
The killer plunged his knife.
From someone police savvy like Dexter, the TV forensic investigator by day, a serial killer by night.
But not everyone's buying into the Hollywood version of this very real story. A former FBI agent tells AOL News it would be naive to think you have to be a cop to learn these skills. One of the greatest teaching tools for criminals are the forensic books and television programs that are out there today. You have serial killers out there reading about other serial killers, learning their techniques, and studying up on police techniques. And until authorities give out any more details, media outlets are booking every ex-detective, investigator, and lawyer they can find to come on the set and explain the killer's behavior.
He may appear normal as far as being able to go get, keep his job and walk around the community, but he's going to have that real manipulative, non-empathetic, controlling kind of behavior.
We know he's very bright. We know he's able to use technology. We know that he's done everything right to avoid capture.
Their main pleasure is not the killing anymore, not after the first one. They can never recapture that excitement. Their pleasure comes from outsmarting the authorities.
Four of the 10 victims were known prostitutes who advertised their services on Craigslist. Police believe that could be how the killer found them and will continue working that lead. For Newsy.com, I'm Jennifer Meckles. Multiple sources, the real story.
Our final murder and mayhem note is our most recent, and it is another gruesome one from ABC News. Last night, Tennessee student kidnapped, dragged into the woods by a camouflaged abductor. It was a home invasion, and apparently there are also reports of forewarnings and threats. On to our Obamasiya updates, where Congress has been delivered articles of impeachment for Obama. Let's listen to lawyer Bruce Fine break it down.
Well, I can read the text of it. It's printed now on Politico website and some other websites, but that's the easiest way to find it. It's got over 8,000 hits already in just about a day. But let me go back to the founding. You know what we're going to do to honor the Republic. I'm speaking a little bit like James Otis and Sam Adams. The 1765 Stamp Act protest that said Americans were not going to reduce themselves to vassals to King George III, that we the people are sovereign and that we're going to chart our own destiny. We're not going to have one individual or group of individuals tell us what's good for us, what's in the national interest, and flout the rule of law. And that's basically the precipice we're standing on today. It's not 1765 in the Stamp Act. It is Barack Obama stating that he can utilize our military offensively anytime he believes in his viewpoint, it advances the national interest, whatever he thinks that is. In Libya, he says it's a humanitarian interest. All I can say is if that level of oppression justifies war unilaterally, we got about 80 countries standing right behind Libya. Start thinking about Zimbabwe, China, Chechnya, Burma, You know, you name it.
Mexico!
We'll be at war forever. And we'll be sending ourselves into further bankruptcy, which we can't afford. It'll mean secrecy. It'll mean suspending habeas corpus. We'll be put in detentions without trials, military commissions instead of civilian commissions. We'll have the greatest amount of invasion of privacy in the history of the United States. The Transportation Security Administration, you know, they'll be looking up every single crevice we've got.
We'll cut it short right there. We still have so many clips and we still have so many other things to go into on our Obamasiah updates. Of course, the Obamasiah gave a speech the other night that the Wall Street Journal calls the most dishonest in decades. Another video, as that Bruce Fine clip was from the Alex Jones Show. There is also a recent interview with Lyndon LaRouche that's quite fascinating. We do have a clip, but we'll skip it again as we're now running tight on time. Obama successfully demobilized the anti-war movement. Our own representative from Oregon, Peter DeFazio, says Obama should act like a Democrat. Not really sure if that's a good idea or not. Romney announces bid for presidency. U.S. Congress passes slim down 2011 budget. Meanwhile, Biden dozes off during that dishonest Obama budget speech. And our own flashback to YouTube.com/MediaMonarchy from 2007. Cheney nods off during meeting on California wildfires. And our last Obamasiah note from early this morning from the Washington Times, curdling the cream in everybody's coffee. Do the birthers have a Trump card? Wink, wink. On to our Oregon oddities, where a story I had missed from just a couple of weeks ago, thanks to my man Robert at work for telling me about it, and I found it, and it was there, and NPR is reporting that the Pacific Northwest states are moving to counter the rise in immunization waivers, blaming misinformation.
Record numbers of parents in the Northwest are seeking waivers from mandatory child immunization requirements. The trend alarms public health officials. They say it creates increased risk for disease outbreaks. Oregon, Washington, and Idaho are all moving to sway vaccine skeptics, but passions run high on the issue. All U.S. states require parents to immunize their children before sending them to school.
All right, Angelo, just a little pokey poke. 1, 2, 3, poke.
But in the majority of Western states, parents can exempt their children from mandatory vaccines by signing a form.
It's one-page form, certificate of exemption. I fill out a couple boxes, I sign it, and I'm gone. It's quite easy.
Maybe too easy, says Washington Secretary of Health Mary Selecki.
There is a data point about Washington State I'm not proud of. We have the highest exemption rate in the nation, Washington State, of all 50 states.
In Washington, about 6% of kindergartners come to class unvaccinated. Oregon is close behind at nearly 5.5%. In Idaho, around 4% of incoming kindergartners skipped at least some mandatory shots. Across the region, and including more grades, it adds up to more than 85,000 children. So how did the Northwest get to be such fertile ground for vaccine refusals? There are a wide range of reasons. Stay-at-home mom Nikki Hausch claimed a philosophical exemption to enroll her two sons in preschool and elementary in Olympia.
Washington State parents are really focused on what they're putting in their children's bodies.
Hausch says she carefully researched each vaccine. She accepted some, but she had doubts about the necessity or safety of others.
My biggest concern was I had read a lot of information about children being injured by vaccines and having a child with an immune system challenge. I didn't want to complicate things for him anymore.
Parents can also claim a religious exemption, but state statistics from Washington and Idaho show refusals based on church doctrine account for just a sliver of the total opt-outs. Another slice of parents don't trust the big drug companies that make most vaccines. Then there are parents who simply rebel at the sheer number of shots babies and toddlers get these days if they follow the recommended immunization schedule. Dr. Ed Marcuse saw this in his practice at Children's Hospital in Seattle.
A major concern of parents is that somehow the large number of vaccines will overwhelm the child's immune system.
Marcuse lays that by saying there's no scientific basis for that concern. Another thing he tells anxious parents is that the benefits of vaccination far outweigh the risks.
The fundamental issue is we have two conflicting values, and they are the freedom of the individual and the protection of public health. And the state has a responsibility to do both. And where these two things come to in conflict is if too many people opt out, our communities then become at risk.
The steadily rising number of immunization opt-outs is now drawing a response. The Washington legislature is on the verge of sending the governor a measure that would make it harder to enroll unvaccinated kids in school. These parents would first have to consult with a medical professional. The intention of the bill's sponsors is to counter the, quote, misinformation about vaccines in the media and on the internet. Vaccine skeptics like Ezra Eichmeier testified against being forced into a possible confrontation with doctors or nurses.
This is a decision that comes down to the parents making a parenting decision, and we hold that decision to be very sacred.
Eichmeier prefers the approach Oregon and Idaho are taking. Both states are working on education campaigns. According to national research, fewer than 1% of U.S. children receive no vaccines at all. A portion of that tide of immunization waivers may just reflect really busy lifestyles. Researchers speculate some parents find it easier to sign an opt-out form than to collect all the medical records documenting their kids' shots. I'm Tom Bonsi in Olympia.
And again, that story was reported from NPR and our own OPB, and I'll tie in our related note of West Virginia worry from my current state of Oregon to my home state of West by God, Virginia. West Virginia mom seeks rehearing in immunization case. So we see coast to coast people becoming informed and becoming activated about what is going on. What I'm going to do for you, my friends, as we are quite malleable and it's been a one-man band from the very beginning. I always learned to do radio by myself without any extra producer. So the massive amount of material we have prepared, I'm not going to be able to complete. So we'll save the remainder of our Oregon Oddities, Police State International, War Whores, and West Virginia Worry updates for an upcoming episode. Coming very soon, I would guess. And we'll skip to the end. As, again, my man Clyde Lewis of Ground Zero Media notes, no one expects a Civil War meme. First shots mark the 150th anniversary of the beginning of the United States Civil War. And we'll take a little clip from CNN that gives us the broad, publicly acceptable version of the Civil War. And as I don't have to tell you, the real story is, of course, one, always far more interesting, and two, is always far more damning.
The Civil War was a defining moment for the United States, and even though the last shot was fired in 1865, the outcome of the war still has an effect on Americans to this day. For more, we are joined by April Holmes. She is the Schwartz Postdoctoral Fellow at the New School for Social Research. April, thanks for being with us today. We do appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, so 150 years later, we still see reenactments. We still see new books and documentaries coming out about the Civil War. Why is it so fascinating?
Well, I think the thing about the Civil War is that it had such inherent drama to it. I mean, the fact that you had brother fighting against brother, people arrayed, you know, countrymen arrayed against each other, fighting each other. And of course, also the thing important to remember about the Civil War is it marked the end of slavery in the United States. And that is another incredibly dramatic and important turning point in American history.
Yeah, no doubt. You know, while it does fascinate, it does infuriate others as well. Because, I mean, just take this for example. Last year, there were two U.S. governors who elected to have April as the Confederate Heritage Month. And, you know, some people said, you know what, this is representing slavery. That's what the Confederacy represents. But many are saying, no, 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 this is Southern pride. This is honoring fallen heroes. So, I mean, is that a fair debate when people look back at the Civil War?
Well, I think one of the real challenges is, of course, that people want to honor and commemorate those who fought and died on both sides. And one of the points where there really are debates is often comes up around surrounding anniversaries and commemorations of battles, soldiers, leaders who have died. But the thing that I think is really important to remember about the war, and the thing that people both North and South can celebrate, is that it did preserve this nation and the union of the states, and brought about the end of slavery. And that's something I think Americans can agree it's a good thing.
Yeah, those are definitely some big topics that surrounded the war. Why is it so important for people to understand the details of it? I mean, how does it apply to our lives today?
Well, the Civil War actually was a real turning point in American history, and there are three major ways that it continues to shape the United States today. One of those is that really the consolidation of the power of a strong federal government came from fighting the Civil War. In fact, this is sort of topical. The first income tax was created in during the Civil War in the North to fund the war. So the sort of modern government we have today actually came out of the war. And also our economy was also shaped, moving away from the sort of agricultural economy of the South and the sort of industrialization of the North. And then, of course, the expansion of freedom. Not only resulted in the abolition of slavery, but also the three Reconstruction Amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to our Constitution, laid the groundwork for civil liberties to come in the years after the war.
You have studied this through and through. What's the most fascinating thing about the Civil War to you?
Well, I am really drawn to those the human drama of ordinary people caught up in this tremendous event. One thing that really fascinates me is the way that enslaved people in the South took the opportunity of the chaos of the war to run from their plantations and seek their freedom and go out there and force the question of slavery onto the North and make that part of the challenge of the war to end, making the debate over slavery something that was central to the war aims for the North.
And it definitely shaped America, no doubt. You know, as we mentioned, there's been, over 60,000 books on the Civil War. Is there anything new that we're learning today about what happened 150 years ago?
Well, a lot of it is sort of revisiting from different angles and wondering whether or not things could have gone differently. But there are new things to learn, and some of those new directions do come from taking a look at ordinary people's lives, the experience of people living who are caught up in the battle, living on the battlefield, and the experience of ordinary soldiers. You know, these very brave men who fought and died in the war, and that's an area recently that people have been turning to understand. You know, moving away from just studying the great leaders to also looking at the ordinary people's experience.
Right. A lot of lives went into it. What was it? 600,000 Americans.
Yeah, tremendous loss
of
life.
And you can't forget that. All right, April Holm from the New School for Social Research. Thanks so much for your insight. We do appreciate it.
Thank you.
From the Rockefeller Connected News School. Thanks for setting us straight as first shots mark 150 years since start of U.S. Civil War. A related note, interestingly enough, investing in a conspiracy of a past century, Ameritrade's founder produces historical film The Conspirator. Opening Friday at a theater near you. Our few related history mystery updates, an interesting historical piece from Tarpley.net, Wrap the World in Flames, the U.S.-Russian alliance that saved the Union. Meanwhile, the rarest ever copy of Mein Kampf, autographed by Hitler, expected to sell for £30,000. That's the useless UK money, and there's another Hitler meme. Meanwhile, FBI secret report said Nazi war crimes evidence was probably faked. That's from the Associated Press, and we reference that with the probably faked FBI files coming from the vault. Meanwhile, jurors vote to acquit former, quote-unquote, CIA operative and Cuban terrorist Luis Posada Carrillas. More on that from Blacklisted News. And our last note from the IntelHub.com, eugenics and the still unsolved murder of Jane Stanford. So many things to dive into, so many areas and avenues of research. And as we draw this episode to a close, as it's bursting at the seams, and again, all the remainder media we will go over on the next episode, coming very soon, I keep wanting to draw attention to twitter.com/mediamonarchy, where we're putting out tons of interesting info and trying to get connected to all the celebrities that seem to haunt Twitter as we try and grab Morgan Spurlock and Joe Rogan and John Cusack and other folks into alternative politics. Some of the tweets on there as last week's debate about the government shutdown, of course, sum it up with a Simpsons quote, like you can so many other times. Abortions for some, miniature American flags for others. We also note on Sidney Lumet, we note on a new hearing exposes ugly realities of U.S. unpreparedness for upcoming earthquakes. And so many, many other things from fantastic alternative news outlets, my friends. So as we draw it to a close, let me remind you and ask you to hit the donate button at the top right of the page. Your support helps keep Media Monarchy going and growing. And this has been the 214th episode of Media Monarchy. It's April 15th, 2011, and as always, we're broadcasting from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and a huge thanks to zeropointradio.com and revereradio.net and all the other sites and organizations that help spread the word about Media Monarchy, my friends. As I look at my notes, I try and see if I've mentioned everything that I can possibly cram into this episode, and there's just no more time. We'll keep it going. As we have already said number of times in this episode and on so many other previous episodes, my friends, that one, get active or get radioactive, as now we're going to have to get both. But as we really say and we really truly believe here, and I take it as my passion and as my motto and as my mission statement, don't hate the media, become the media. Take care.
MediaMonarchy.com is your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. Featuring weekly radio shows on the Portland Radio Authority, PRARadio.org, the New World Next Week video series with CorbettReport.com, plus special interview episodes, B-sides, mixtapes, and so much more. Send news tips to MediaMonarchy@gmail.com. You can make a donation or mail Media to the Monarchy at P.O. Box 12165, Portland, Oregon 97212. Thanks to all the internet and community radio stations who broadcast these shows, and most of all, thanks to you. Remember, don't hate the media, become the media.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.